Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. A major surge as infections, hospitalizations, and deaths from COVID-19 increase across the country. Some medical experts warn the CDC's latest guidance is creating confusion. Then, rising tensions. Diplomats from the United States and Russia meet amid stark disagreements over Ukraine and the future influence of NATO. And the divided state of America. Deepening polarization prompts efforts to bridge the gap in U.S. politics by tapping into people's shared experiences.
There are not simple fixes to this. We're going to have to recognize, like addiction, that this is a long-term problem that has been gaining steam for decades, but we can do it.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The Biden administration is moving tonight to make it easier to get at-home tests for COVID-19. The White House says starting Saturday, private insurers must cover 8 at-home tests per person per month. Also today, the CDC warned against travel to Canada because of a rise in COVID-19 cases there. And in China, parts of the city of Tianjin were locked down less than a month before the Winter Olympics in Beijing, 75 miles away. For the first time, doctors have transplanted the heart of a pig into a human patient. The University of Maryland Medical Center says the 57-year-old man is doing well 3 days after the surgery. He was ineligible for a human heart transplant. The pig had been genetically modified to prevent the human body from immediately rejecting the heart. The death toll from Sunday's apartment building fire in the Bronx was lowered to 17 today, including 8 children. Officials in New York said some victims were double counted after the city's deadliest fire since 1990. Investigators blamed a space heater for igniting the flames. Many of the victims were West African immigrants, as Mayor Eric Adams noted today.
This is a global tragedy because of the Bronx and New York City is representative of the ethnicities and cultures across the globe. And so everyone is feeling the pain of what we are experiencing. But I would tell you this, and I say over and over again, we're going to get through this moment.
The New York tragedy came less than a week after a house fire in Philadelphia killed a dozen people. The man who bought the gun used in the Kenosha, Wisconsin killings pleaded no contest to a misdemeanor today. Dominic Black will pay a $2,000 fine under the deal. In 2020, he bought an assault-style rifle for Kyle Rittenhouse, who was underage. Rittenhouse later shot 2 people to death during racial justice protests. He was acquitted in November. In Kazakhstan, officials say last week's protests have ended, with nearly 8,000 people arrested and Russian-led troops on the ground. Streets in Almaty, the country's largest city, were mostly empty today. In a teleconference, Russia's President Vladimir Putin vowed to oppose revolts against regional leaders.
Of course, we understand the events in Kazakhstan are not the first and far from the last attempt to interfere in the internal affairs of our states. I agree with President Lukashenko of Belarus. The measures taken by our alliance have clearly shown we will not allow the situation to be rocked at home, and we will not allow so-called color revolutions to take place.
In addition to the arrest, Kazakh officials say that 164 people were killed in the protests. Insured global losses from extreme weather hit $120 billion last year. That's the second highest amount ever. The world's largest reinsurer, Munich Re, today cited climate change as a main factor. Meanwhile, U.S. emissions of greenhouse gases rebounded sharply last year. The research firm Rhodium Group cites a surge in coal use. The Federal Reserve Board's vice chair, Richard Clarida, is resigning on Friday, 2 weeks before his term ends. He had been criticized over stock trades he made in February of 2020, as the pandemic first threatened the world economy. He is the third Fed official to resign over the issue. The IRS announced today that federal income tax season will open more than 2 weeks early this year on January 24th. The agency says that it needs extra time to cope with potential delays from the COVID surge and less funding than it requested. On Wall Street today, a slow start to the week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 162 points to close at 36,068. The Nasdaq rose 7 points. The S&P 500 slipped 6. And several passings of note. Tonight, comedian Bob Saget is being remembered for long-running stints on TV's Full House and America's Funniest Home Videos in the late 1980s and early 90s. He was found dead in his Florida hotel on Sunday. A generation grew up watching Saget on Full House, seen here as a widowed father playing with one of his three young girls.
Michelle breaks for the basket and goes right through my legs.
Okay.
She's going for that super duper high flying baby skying junior slamma jamma. Talk about serious hang time.
Michelle scores!
In your face!
In your face.
Bob Saget was 65 years old. Also on Sunday, Dwayne Hickman, TV's Dobie Gillis of the 1960s, died in Los Angeles after battling Parkinson's disease. He was 87 years old. And Oscar-winning lyricist Marilyn Bergman passed away in Los Angeles on Saturday. She and her husband teamed on hundreds of songs, including The Way We Were and Windmills of Your Mind. Marilyn Bergman was 93 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, the prospects for easing tensions after the U.S. and Russia hold high-stakes talks. We examine the latest push for voting rights legislation in Congress, how a memorial to shooting victims in Tucson elevates art born from tragedy, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The latest guidance from the CDC on isolation and testing for COVID-19 has received intense pushback. As William Brangham reports, many health experts are now criticizing what the CDC has said and how CDC officials have said it.
That's right, Judy. The CDC said if you get COVID, you don't have to isolate for 10 days like before. You can cut that down to 5. But it also said people don't need a negative test to resume regular life. Joining a chorus of criticism, the American Medical Association issued a rare but strong rebuke, saying that the CDC's new recommendations were, quote, not only confusing, but are risking further spread of the virus. The man who wrote those words is Dr. Gerald Harman. He's the president of the AMA. Dr. Harman, great to have you on the NewsHour. I'd like to have a better sense of what it is that is bothering you about what the CDC did. Am I right that you're okay that people might leave COVID isolation after 5 days, but only if they have a negative test? Is that your issue?
William, thanks for having me. And that you've nailed it. That's my issue as a frontline provider. We have a lot of evidence that shows that viral might stop after 5 days. We don't know as much about the Omicron variant as we'd like. Of course, we're learning on the fly, but 5 days seems a little quick to let someone release back into the wild without at least negative testing before they're going back, even if they're wearing masks, even if they're wearing medical grade masks, putting someone back into the environment that could spread this. And some of the data shows that as many as 31% of those after 5 days still shed the virus. That's a little inherent risk that I'm not willing to buy into right now.
I mean, the CDC director, when asked about this, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, said she implied that rapid tests were not as reliable as they've been sold, although that's somewhat contrary to what she said at the beginning of the pandemic. What do you make of that? Do you think that rapid tests are reliable?
Well, I use them. All of us use them. We make a determination whether to put someone in isolation when they come in. We use the test that we have available, and that's a rapid test. We tell people all the time, get a hold of a rapid test. If you think you might have been exposed or have symptoms, we tell you go do a rapid test. That's been a relatively common standard. And if it's good enough to make the diagnosis, I would hope that it's good enough to make the undiagnosis that you're no longer contagious. Now, they're going to be like any test, some false negatives, some false positives, but it's been the standard. They're generally a good indicator of whether a patient is infectious.
I mean, anyone who has actually tried to go out and purchase one of those rapid tests knows that they are in incredibly short supply right now. And your letter seemed to imply that the CDC made this decision because of that shortage. Do you believe that that's really true?
Listen, this is not the AMA or other healthcare agencies against the CDC. We love them. We're supportive of them. They're a public health messenger that we rely on. So we're a little bit concerned with the messaging and the confused messaging, because I think testing is good to have. I wish we had more tests available, the rapid test. I, like others, are struggling to find tests in the community. Almost every day, in fact, every day people call me, hey, I need tested and I can't find one. I'll tell you a story. I bought a handful of them, four of them, when I could still get four about a week or two ago. And I've used them when my neighbors come knocking on my door, literally, to test them, because I need to make a decision about recommending my personal advice to my patients.
I mean, there's an echo here about what happened with masks at the very beginning of the pandemic. I mean, Dr. Fauci himself has now acknowledged that there was the worry that there weren't enough N95 masks and they didn't recommend them for people. You mentioned the somewhat confused and confusing messaging of the CDC. Is this something that has been frustrating to you for a while?
Well, again, this is science. This is not mathematics. So the numbers may change. The data may indicate different transmission variants. We're learning, all of us, the CDC, all of my scientist colleagues, myself on the front lines, we're learning. So the messaging may change at times, but it's not in any deliberate format to confuse people or because we don't know what we're doing or the CDC doesn't. Science changes. It is a changing discipline, and data tells us what to advise. So yes, we're now recommending medical grade mask. I'll use this morning, and I've got an N95 mask for when I'm in the environment, but I don't use cloth mask anymore because I think the messaging and the science shows they're not as protective, especially with the transmissibility of the Omicron variant.
So if a patient comes to you and says, look, I tested positive, I've been in isolation for 4 or 5 days, CDC says I can get out without a test, but they're not sure about their symptoms and they cannot get a test, what would you advise them to do?
You know, they do come to me with that very question. You're exactly right. So that's not just a hypothetical thought experiment. That's real time. And I'm going to stick with my recommendation, not necessarily the AMA's recommendation, but it's going to be, if you're not sure, you've only been 5 days since the onset of symptoms or the date of positive testing, then I think if you don't have an available test that helps support that you are not contagious or not infected, why don't you wait a couple more days? And then 7 days might be a reasonable, prudent recommendation that you could go back to work. If I did test you positive, I'd wait a couple days later and get you tested again. We're not trying to pick a magic number. We're trying to meet someplace in the middle. We're trying to do the best we can with the data we have and use common sense. And that's the challenge for all of us right now. None of us are deliberately trying to release people into the wild that are infectious or contagious. We're trying to do the best we can to keep our schools open, our hospitals open, our businesses open, help the economy. I understand the motivation, but the science still is catching up with the reality.
All right, Dr. Gerald Harmon, president of the American Medical Association, thank you so much for being here.
William, thanks for having me. Thanks for being part of the solution, and you and the PBS folks being a source of reliable medical information and for being on the side of science. Thank you again.
It is one of the most significant crises with Russia since the end of the Cold War. 100,000 Russian troops on Ukraine's border that the U.S. says could invade within weeks. Today in Geneva, senior American and Russian diplomats met, kicking off a week of intense diplomacy. Nick Schifrin reports.
The photo op was tense and silent. U.S. and Russian negotiators met for 8 hours of bilateral talks that Deputy Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov described as a possible basis for agreement.
A professional, practical conversation by itself puts us in an optimistic mood, of course, but by all means, the main questions remain.
Speaking to reporters by phone, Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman called it a frank and forthright preliminary dialogue.
Today was a discussion, a better understanding of each other and each other's priorities and concerns. It was not what you would call a negotiation.
The crisis caused by 100,000 Russian troops deployed to Ukraine's borders. The U.S. warns Russia has plans to mobilize twice that number and possibly invade. But what the U.S. raised today, mutual limits on Eastern European exercises like these in Poland and on missile deployments by reviving the defunct Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, or INF, that banned an entire class of nuclear weapons.
Even on things that are not Russian priorities, we had useful discussion and exchanges today that will help inform our way forward.
Russia's public priorities expand much further. In December, it released demands including roll back all NATO forces and weapons in Europe to 1997, and no further enlargement of NATO, including Ukraine. That would rewrite decades of U.S. and NATO policy and the map. In 1949, NATO's eastern border was Italy. By 1997, it had added 4 more countries for a total of 16. Since then, in 5 rounds of expansion, it's grown to 30 countries, including those on Russia's border. In 2008, NATO said Ukraine and Georgia would become future members. The Biden administration says it refuses to negotiate NATO expansion or the deployment of U.S. troops in Eastern Europe, which Ryabkov today said was still Russia's priorities.
For us, it's absolutely mandatory to make sure that Ukraine never ever becomes member of NATO.
But in Kyiv this weekend, Ukrainians who look west urged the U.S. to stand up to Putin. It's been 8 years since Russia invaded eastern Ukraine. And still, this weekend, Ukrainian soldiers fought Russian-backed separatists. Kyiv insists that Moscow cannot be allowed to block its NATO membership, as Deputy Prime Minister Olga Stefanishnya said today in Brussels.
We have inherent sovereign right to choose our own security arrangements, including treaties and alliances. What Russia is doing is tries to impose its agenda instead of returning to the negotiation table.
So did today's talks create a diplomatic pathway to avoid war in Ukraine? For that, we get 2 views. Deborah Kagan had a 30-year career as an American diplomat where she focused on arms control and NATO. And Dmitry Trenin joins us from Moscow, where he directs the Carnegie Moscow Center think tank. Welcome to the NewsHour to both of you. Dmitry Trenin, let me start with you. There are Russian troops on the Ukrainian border. There are Russian demands that the U.S. had to respond to today. To today's talks create a pathway for a diplomatic solution?
Well, it's too early to tell. I think that, as Deputy Foreign Minister Ryabkov said, they will assess the results of the talks today and, in fact, yesterday. Also, the talks that are scheduled for the 12th of January with NATO, and to some extent what happens the following day, the next day in Vienna at the OSCE. And then they will come to a decision whether a new round of talks is possible, is promising, or whether that's it. So I think we are at an inflection point in not only in U.S.-Russian relations, but more broadly in Russian-Western relations.
Deborah Kagan, do you believe that we're at an inflection point and the outcome wasn't decided today, but in fact will be only decided after a week's worth of diplomatic meetings?
I don't even think it'll be decided after a week's worth of diplomatic meetings. And I think that inflection point has been going on for quite a long period of time. It's not just right this second. So I think that a lot of talking has to be had, and there's been no evidence of any Russian de-escalation to this point, which I think should be a precursor to moving forward on any of the other diplomatic solutions.
So Dmitry Trenin, let's go into what the U.S. administration has proposed. In response to a series of requests, many of which are about NATO and Ukraine, the U.S. administration is focused on mutual concessions on arms control, on revisiting the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, and on restricting exercises in Eastern Europe. Will that be enough?
I think the short answer is no. I think that the issue of INF forces in Europe is certainly something that Russia would want to address and resolve. I think that Russia is also interested in caps on troops in its vicinity, on exercises by NATO forces. But most important issues for Russia were membership, or rather non-membership, of Ukraine in NATO and the non-expansion of military infrastructure of NATO, no strike weapons that can reach Russia in Europe, including in Ukraine. And he also mentioned a rollback of NATO's infrastructure to where it was back in 1997. So he called those three elements, core elements, key elements of the Russian position. And unless those were addressed in a manner that would be found acceptable by the Russians, other things would not be pursued.
Deborah Kagan, many of those proposals are dead on arrival for the administration. So do you believe it will be enough for this administration to propose things like arms control and exercises to respond to and try and defuse this crisis?
I think it's great to put those things out there, but it depends on how adamant, as Dmitry said, the Russians are on this. If they're going to continue to insist that NATO has to pull back to pre-1997 borders, that's palpably ridiculous. That's not going to happen, because Washington and the rest of NATO are never going to treat, for example, Berlin and Paris and London better than you treat Warsaw and Vilnius and Bucharest. And that's what the Russians are asking for. And I think that is an absolute non-starter. And I think Deputy Secretary Sherman was very, very clear on that today.
Dmitry Trenin, Deborah Kagan is not the only one who calls these ideas ridiculous or non-starters. Do you believe that they are designed to be rejected and become the prelude either for war or some kind of permanent Russian presence on Ukraine's border?
Well, in my judgment, the third condition that the Russians are putting forth, i.e. the rollback of NATO's military installations that have been built in the territories of the new NATO states, that this is rather less important for Russia than the two other issues raised by Mr. Ryabkov. So this could be an area where Russia potentially could give, should it see progress on the truly important issues, non-expansion of NATO and non-expansion of NATO's infrastructure beyond where it is today.
Deborah Kagan, again, the U.S. and NATO are not willing to provide any kind of solid assurance to Russia that NATO won't expand. So do you fear that these Russian demands are an excuse to be denied and an excuse to go to war?
I wouldn't say that it's an excuse to go to war. I do think the Russians know that these are going to be denied. I think the Russians tried to split some of the older members of NATO from some of the newer members of NATO. And that's to be expected. But I don't think that this is, I don't think the Russians need an excuse to further invade Ukraine. And so I think that might be a misnomer.
Dmitry Trenin, just quickly in about 30 seconds that we have left, the proposal there that Deborah Kagan lays out would take some time to actually negotiate. Does Moscow have that kind of patience during this crisis?
Well, I think Moscow insists on moving ahead swiftly. But the important thing is that Moscow's agenda needs to be at the core of the negotiations. And that, I think, is non-negotiable for the Russian side. Unless those issues are addressed, other things will probably not get the attention that they may deserve.
Deborah Kagan, quickly, just in 30 seconds, do you see that at the core of the agenda in these talks?
I see that's part of what Moscow is hoping to get. But I just want to point out one quick fact here. There's about 60,000 U.S. forces in all of Europe, and only about 6,000 of those are deployed east of Berlin, for example. And of those, about 4,000 are in Poland. So if you want to talk about exercises, NATO doesn't do 100,000 person exercises. They don't. They haven't. They're not going to do it in the future. And so it's sometimes ridiculous to say we have 100,000 troops here and it's just an exercise. And so I just want to point out that I think this shows how ridiculous some of the Russian positions are on this, because the numbers just don't match up at all.
Deborah Kagan, Dmitry Trenin, thank you very much to you both.
You're welcome.
We spent much of last week trying to examine what still divides our country and the deep polarization that preceded the January 6th riots last year. Tonight, Paul Solman looks at multiple efforts to bridge those major political and cultural divides in the U.S., beginning with smaller steps forward.
Polarization in America. The data are unreal. According to a poll just out, a projected 25 million American adults think force is at least somewhat justified to restore Donald Trump to the presidency. In a poll before the last election, 18% of Democrats approved of violence if their candidate lost, and 15% of Republicans and 20% of Democrats agreed that the country would be better off if large numbers of the opposing party just died.
We are in a crisis.
Psychologist Peter Coleman runs Columbia University's Center for Cooperation and Conflict Resolution.
So how bad is polarization in America, Peter, compared to the past?
It's bad. I mean, John Meacham, the historian, has compared today as being similar to where America was in the 1850s, right before the U.S. Civil War.
Coleman's RX is detailed in a recent book, The Way Out, which begins with a fatal 1994 shooting rampage at two abortion clinics outside Boston. In the wake of that tragedy, activists on both sides of the issue agreed to meet. Pro-life Barbara Thorpe's image of the pro-choice activists?
Hard and harsh. I am angry.
Pro-choice Episcopal priest Ann Fowler's image of pro-life advocates?
Not thoughtful. Not deep.
And, says Peter Coleman,
they still remained opposed to one another on the issue of abortion, on pro-life, pro-choice, but they developed affection for one another and relationships that were thick and important. And ultimately, they changed the probabilities around violence in America on this issue.
No changed minds, however.
So does that in some sense mean that the experience was a net negative?
No, it was an absolute net positive. It was one of the best, hardest and best things I've ever done. It changed me. I think it changed all of us irrevocably.
They've been friends for 28 years.
We at my center study deeply divided societies that at some point stop and pivot and choose to change course.
And pivoting, many Americans now are, through a host of bridging efforts.
There are 7,000 organizations and individuals that we have put on a map.
Princeton's Neilan Parker tracks efforts to come together.
But if you're asking the question of how many people across the country are interested in participating in bridging organizations, that is just the tip of the iceberg.
Organizations like Resetting the Table, Braver Angels, the Greater Good Science Center, which recorded this bridging encounter. Liberal Isaac was shown conservative Kristen's bio. He didn't know she was watching in the next room.
Trump supporters, I mean, it's just, there's no way around it. Like, they're mentally deranged. You're not right in the head.
Because I like Trump right away, he says, I'm mentally deranged. He don't know me, you know what I'm saying? And that's wrong, you know? That's prejudice to me.
But then they learned that each had experienced great loss. Kristen's sister died when she was 16. Aunt and grandparents who raised her died in quick succession. Isaac lost his mother, his grandfather, his cat.
Kidders, my cat, I found her headless carcass on the road. She got run over by a car, and like, it was just too much.
By the time they met in person.
This is Isaac.
Hi, I'm mentally deranged.
Political differences were becoming a humorous footnote.
You and I see certain things similar. You and I have had similar experiences with loss.
Yes.
This experience we're sharing is gonna color my interactions going forward mm-hmm. with other people.
Because you never know what someone might be going through in their life or what's, you know, the problems they have. So just don't be quick to get angry.
And then there's one small step, an offshoot of NPR's StoryCorps. In 2016, Amina Amdeen attended an anti-Trump rally in Texas. Counter-protester Joseph Weidnecht wore a MAGA hat. They came to StoryCorps to remember the moment.
And I noticed that you were surrounded by some people, and I noticed that they were being kind of threatening, and then somebody snatched your hat off your head. And that's the point where something kind of snapped inside me, because I wear a Muslim hijab, and I've been in situations where people have tried to snatch it off my head.
Wow. I don't think we could be any further apart as people, and yet it was just kind of like this common, that's not okay moment. You are genuinely the only Muslim person I know.
You know, it's hard to hate up close.
Dave Isay created StoryCorps, and his experience there has taught him people like to get up close. Moreover,
there's an organization called More in Common that talks about the exhausted majority, and that's 93% of the country. 93% of the country are exhausted by the divides and, you know, want to find a way out.
Like the name of Peter Coleman's book. And even Congress has several bridging efforts, including the devoutly bipartisan Veterans Caucus for Country.
Veterans get things done, and that's what they learn in the service, and they set aside personal differences and political differences, and they dig the foxhole.
Conservative Texas Republican Van Taylor, who served in Iraq, and Virginia Democrat Elaine Lurie.
Commanding officer, businesswoman, mom.
There's rules within the caucus that say 75% of the members of the caucus have to agree on this for the caucus to endorse it. And so that requires working together, coming to the table, making trade-offs.
Finally, an effort I've worked on, the American Exchange Project, a domestic foreign exchange program for high school seniors based on the underlying principle of coming together, overcoming stereotypes.
There's definitely a stereotype of, you know, the South being poor and uneducated.
Sam Bucher was a high school senior in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Letitia Vallejo in Kilgore, Texas. When she first met kids like Sam online.
They were more privileged than us. Like, you could tell by, like, their education and everything, like, the way they talked. I was scared that, since I didn't have that education or anything, like, we were more underprivileged.
For 2 years, in online hangouts featuring everything from push-up contests to sibling squat challenges, debates over the Confederate flag to is a hot dog a sandwich, high schoolers north and south have connected, and this July hit the road to see each other's America.
Okay, I'm about to go on a T.
Are you excited?
Train station for the Woo! First time.
For Alana Alsworth from Lake Charles, Louisiana, her very first trip away from home or on a subway. But back to the Way Out author for the key question.
What are the odds that America is going to actually achieve anything like reconciliation and bridging anytime soon?
The odds are good, but the work is hard. There are not simple fixes to this. We're going to have to recognize, like addiction, that this is a long-term problem that has been, you know, gaining steam for decades, but we can do it. And I think the urgency of certainly violence that we see on the streets is something that will motivate us.
And as they said goodbye after 2 weeks, the kids in the American Exchange Project at least had taken the first small step.
End of vlog. End of vlog.
They'd made friends and recorded it in a blog to share back home. For the PBS NewsHour, Paul Salmon.
Senators return to work in Washington today as Democrats launch their most concerted push on voting rights yet. Lisa Desjardins is here with the latest on where legislation stands and what comes next. So, hello, Lisa. We know the Democrats are pushing two pieces of legislation as President Biden and the Vice President Harris get ready to go to Atlanta to talk about it. But walk us through what's in those two pieces of legislation.
Judy, many of our viewers know the Constitution states clearly that states run elections, but Congress has the power to pass rules governing the elections of members of Congress. So these are two bills dealing with that. The first is the broader one. This one is called the Freedom to Vote Act. In the Freedom to Vote Act, this would essentially set national rules for how our elections should work, the federal elections. They would ban gerrymandering for congressional seats. States would have to offer vote by mail or 2 weeks of early voting. States would be able to require photo IDs to vote, but they would have to accept many forms, including potentially utility bills. This would also include an expansion of registration, automatic registration in every state at DMVs, for example. There's a lot more in this bill, but essentially think of this as something that has national standards for these kind of big ticket items for how and when you can go to the pool, to the polls. The other bill, which is called the John Lewis Voting Rights Accountability Act, is more narrow. It is focused instead on preventing discrimination at the poll. And for one of the main cruxes of this bill is to restore what's called preclearance of state laws, if they have shown a past history and a record of discrimination. Many of our viewers will remember this is something that was part of our voting rights law, but the Supreme Court in 2013 overturned the idea of preclearance and said Congress has to decide to put that in place. That's what this bill would do.
So that's what the Democrats want, Lisa. But we know the Republicans have blocked a vote so far on either one of these. And explain to us what their arguments are, and then what are the Democrats trying to do next?
Well, I should mention this isn't entirely partisan. Lisa Murkowski, the senator of Alaska, does support the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, but only that one. So let's talk then about what other Republicans who oppose both of these bills say. Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate leader today, took to the floor, and he read this. He said these remarks. He said, historically, the Senate has taken up elections legislation on careful bipartisan basis. We've made sure not to trample on the rights of voters and the proper roles of local officials. He's saying that this goes too far, that this is a federal takeover of elections. Of course, Democrats push back and say, listen, gerrymandering has benefited Republicans. The Washington Post did a survey, and since 2011, by far, gerrymandered districts across this country have benefited Republicans politically. Now, there is, of course, also some historic elements here, including the Civil War itself and laws against discrimination that went in place with the Civil Rights Act in the 1950s that Democrats want to return to, and some Republicans don't.
And meantime, Lisa, some Republicans have come forward with another issue they want to look at and are talking about legislation, and that has to do with the Electoral College. Tell us about that.
This is connected, but it's important to know. This is called the Electoral Count Act, and it is important to know it is very specific. It is specific to even January 6th. And the confusion over that day, the confusion over the certification of our presidential election. And for example, Vice President Mike Pence, his role under current law, under the current Electoral Count Act, is not clear. It is open to interpretation. Some say that he may have some power in the Senate and over this. Others say, of course, no, he doesn't have any power over deciding the electoral process here. What's going on here is that Republicans say, we're willing to talk about clearing up this messy law that is from 1876, another messy time. Democrats say, wait a minute, we also want to clarify how the electoral count goes. We think there is a problem too, but we don't think that that should take the place of voting rights legislation, which we think addresses a much larger problem of suppression, Democrats say. They would like to do both. For now, they're not going to take the electoral count changes until they get more in the Voting Rights Act. We're going to be talking more about this week, Judy.
Yes, we are. We're going to spend a good bit of time this week looking at the effort to do something about voter access and voting rights. Lisa Desjardins, thank you. And for more on the political stakes of voting rights, it's time for Politics Monday with Tamara Keith of NPR and Lisa Lehrer of The New York Times. Amy Walter is away. Hello to both of you. So, Tam, let's pick up where we left off with Lisa's reporting, Lisa Desjardins' reporting, and that is we are going to see a push this week. We know President Biden, Vice President Harris, headed to Atlanta tomorrow to speak about voting rights. Tell us what has prompted this push right now by the president.
the White House has said that the president's two top priorities are passing the Build Back Better Act and getting some sort of voting rights legislation through. And obviously, with the anniversary of January 6th, there was a lot more discussion around voting rights and around what happened on that day, including what the former president said and has continued to say. He's fighting with a Republican senator today about whether the election was stolen or not. The Republican senator is speaking the truth, Senator Rounds, saying that the election wasn't stolen. Former President Trump continues to claim that the election was stolen from him. And that big lie is the basis of a lot of local and state legislation around voting that Democrats are really concerned about. They see it as existential.
And to Lisa Lehrer now, is this something that is seen to have real prospects of changing minds? I mean, we know the president, they're going to be speaking tomorrow in Atlanta, but what does the landscape look like out there?
Well, the reality in the Senate is the same reality that it's been for the past year or so, which is that Democrats need basically every single one of their members to get something through on voting rights. As Lisa mentioned earlier, there's only one Republican who's showing any inclination to support either one of these bills. So that means what would need to happen here for either of these proposals to actually become law would be an upending or a changing of the filibuster rules. And we really have no indication as of yet that the people that these issues always seem to come down to these days, Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema, have any will to do that. So, you know, some of what's happening here is a political contrast that the White House is trying to draw. I think the president and the administration spent much of the first year, not exclusively, but trying to hold back some of their harshest criticism of Republicans. And now, as you know, the country is starting to move a little bit towards midterms. The White House is certainly starting to think more about the midterms. You see Biden and Harris trying to draw that sharper contrast to start framing up these midterm elections that we'll have less than a year now as a choice between their vision of the country and a Republican vision of the country. So I think part of this is, sure, he wants to get something done on voting rights for sure. But I also think there's something going on here about laying the early sort of political arguments for the election to come.
And Tam, when it comes to the Republicans, it's not as if they've never supported voting rights. They were certainly on board back in 1965 with the big voting rights law. Republican presidents have signed extensions of that law time and again. What has changed in Republican thinking?
Well, this, as you say, used to be bipartisan. Passing voting rights legislation, renewing voting rights legislation, was bipartisan, as Lisa Desjardins reported. Then the Supreme Court took out some of the legs of the Voting Rights Act, and it has now been years and years without Congress being able to come together on this, in part because there is just a dramatically different perception of what the problem is. And our polling, the NPR PBS NewsHour Marist polling, other polls indicate that, you know, Republicans and Democrats agree that democracy is threatened, but they completely disagree about what the problem is. Republicans think that voter fraud and you know, Democrats are out to steal the election. And Democrats are concerned about erosions of the ability of people to exercise their right to vote. It's just an erosion of what used to be an area of agreement. And for many Republicans, I mean, this has been sort of a slow march with these bills passing. Obviously, the big lie around the last election put gasoline on it, but this is not a new thing. Talking about voter integrity or so-called voter integrity.
And to Lisa, I mean, in terms of the purely political thinking on the part of Democrats around this, is this seen as an issue that could help them in the November midterms?
Well, I think a lot of Democrats see this as an issue that could help them just in terms of, you know, having more access to voting for their voters, you know, making sure that polling places have longer hours, that there's more drop boxes, that the trend towards voting by mail continues. So certainly that's a piece of it. I do think it's also an issue that many Democrats believe could motivate parts of their base. But I have to admit, Judy, it's really hard to see, given the times we are living in, the ongoing pandemic, concerns people have about inflation and their personal financial situation, that a huge groundswell of people, although they are, as Tam correctly points out, concerned about the future of American democracy. But it's hard to see that this huge groundswell of people comes out and casts ballots solely on this issue, or even sees this issue as really like the driving force for their vote, particularly as we drag into this third year of this pandemic.
Well, we only have a little bit of time left. But Tam, I do want to ask you about Paul Solomon's reporting about efforts, small efforts, but around the country to bring people together. I think I know the answer to this based on what you've just been talking about, but what does it look like the prospects are that there will be some success in trying to get people to work together to see each other's points of view?
I actually saw a little bit of hope in the level at which people were engaged in local elections in this last cycle of elections. People were paying attention to school boards and city councils in a way that maybe they hadn't in the past. And generally speaking, focusing on national politics is not going to be where we find, as Americans, ways to come together. But it's the small scale stuff where there is some tiny little piece of hope. But no, things are grim. Things are grim in terms of faith in institutions, up and down.
Lisa, do you have any brighter forecast to share with us?
I mean, I'm pretty dark. I'm sort of with Tam on this one. I wish I had more sunshine to offer here, but I have to tell you, when I talk to historians to kind of get their sense of, is there an analogous period to the moment we're living in American history? They talk about things like the run-up to the Civil War, the tumult of the 60s and 70s. So not exactly these sort of kumbaya moments in American history. And just from being out there and talking to voters and seeing where people get their information, who they talk to, what their communities look like, it just appears that we are more divided than ever. And the politicians in our political system have a real incentive to kind of exploit those divides and just sort of continue these divisions.
Well, be that as it may, we can still applaud these efforts, the kinds of small efforts but meaningful ones that Paul Solomon was focused on in that report. Thank you both. Politics Monday, Tam Rakeith and Lisa Lehrer. Thank you.
You're welcome.
This past weekend, January 8th, marked the day when, in 2011, a gunman opened fire at a political event in Arizona. It was a moment that underscored both the dangerous divisions and the epidemic of gun violence in this country. As part of our arts and culture series, Canvas, Stephanie Tsai visits a memorial in Tucson that is part of a new and tragic American art genre.
Tucson's January 8th memorial is steeped in symbolism, starting with its location.
It's like we are walking into healing arms.
Coming into view as one passes through the portico of the historic Pima County Courthouse and near City Hall. The memorial to Tucson's deadliest modern mass shooting sits in the civic heart of the city. That was intentional, says artist Rebecca Mendez, a professor at UCLA, who, along with landscape architects, designed the memorial.
It became clear that this was an attack on democracy, an attack on the most important right that people have.
Meeting with a congressional representative.
Exactly. Meeting and exercising your right to have a democratic process.
It was during a meeting between then Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords of Tucson and her constituents on January 8, 2011, that a gunman opened fire, targeting Giffords, who was severely wounded. 18 others were shot, and 6 victims died, ranging in age from 9 to 79. 1 year ago, on the 10th anniversary of the shootings, the memorial was quietly dedicated. It was the height of the pandemic, so it received little attention. It's called The Embrace, two berms curved toward each other. The structure is surrounded by desert blooms within six gardens, one for each of those killed. On the inner walls, punctures that conjure bullet holes. At night, they look like constellations. Golden light illuminates the voids. Some of the bullet holes are filled with modern-day petroglyphs that symbolize the varied lives, values, and ideals of each victim and survivor. The embrace honors the victims of a modern-day mass shooting, but it also symbolically and subtly references the way guns have shaped this region's history, especially for the indigenous tribes who consider this their ancestral land.
It affected all of us that live in the area.
Bernard Siqueiros is a member of the Tohono O'odham tribe, whose people have lived in this cactus-strewn desert for more than 10,000 years. A former tribal arts educator, the memorial's designers sought his input during their research.
To incorporate that in that kind of memorial, I think is very honoring and appropriate.
Petroglyphs, he says, were traditionally used to record events before written language existed among tribes here.
These symbols in a memorial, you know, especially now in modern times where you have written language and video and other kinds of things, this memorial using those symbols will continue to tell that story so that people don't forget.
I was only in the hospital 24 hours, and so
many can't forget.
January 8th in Tucson is beautiful.
Mary Reed remembers the day of the shootings in stark detail.
We heard what sounded like fireworks. I got a sting in my arm, and my body started moving. No thought. I picked Emma up and I threw her against the wall. And I just covered her with my body, and then the screaming started.
Emma is her daughter, then 17.
And you could hear gunshots then very clearly, and a man walking towards us.
He was deliberately aiming for Emma.
And that got my ire up, and I, without letting her up, turned around to look him in the face because I thought, you're going to shoot me another time. You better be looking me in the eye.
Mary Reed's most evocative petroglyph, a mama bear and her cub.
Mary's story, there's nothing more courageous.
Reed has described the memorial as playful. Visitors can make rubbings on the petroglyphs, bringing a piece of the memorial home. Twin reflecting pools overflow with water that caresses the names of victims as though with falling tears. Every detail researched, sketched, and sometimes, says artist Rebecca Mendez, disputed. She had wanted the memorial to take a more overt stance against guns.
This country has an epidemic, it's a disease of gun violence. My statement, my personal statement, would have been stronger. And at the same time, when you are doing public art, you really are intertwining yourself with the community, and there's a give and take.
It's a conversation other communities in the process of building tributes to victims of mass shootings are having. Artist renderings show plans for memorials in Newtown and Orlando. Completed mass shooting memorials include Columbine, El Paso, and Aurora. The memorial in Tucson, seen from above, shows an abstraction of the figure 8 for January 8th, and in the artist's eye, another symbol.
The idea of January 8, if you think of the Mobius, is the number 8 sideways. So in your walking, meditating, in a sense, you could create that Mobius. And it really is the idea of continuity. We will prevail as a civilization. That is my hope.
The embrace tells a somber story, repeated so many times in this country that memorials to mass shooting victims have become their own American art form. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai in Tucson, Arizona.
So hard to accept that gun violence is so common in this country. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, stay safe, and we'll see you soon.